own project. Ah, recording in progress. Got it. Let me click on got it. Great. Hopefully I'm back. So today I'm going to chat with you about the Rome project. It's been a really interesting and fun collaboration. So here are my collaborators on the project. We've been looking at these large language models for some time now. And we found some interesting things that we're excited to share with you today. So the question that drives our project is really simple. What we want to know is, what does a neural network know? And how does it know it? And so the reason this is really interesting problem for us, and we think it's important, is that it used to be the way that we thought about AI was that we train these models to learn a bunch of things that we explicitly taught them, right? But now we're having a lot of success with unsupervised training methods. Unsupervised learning in a lot of domains is starting to really work. And so we're starting to get these really interesting AI models that are learning a lot of things that we didn't explicitly teach them, which sort of leads to the question, what the heck are they learning? What do they know? And so probably the most fascinating example of this right now is the autoregressive transformer models. And so as we know, transformers have been tremendously successful since they were invented by Ashish Vaswani at Google. Basically, transformers, what they're really good at is imitating text. So to program a transformer, you fundamentally just show it some text to imitate. So we could take 40 gigabytes of web text like this. And you train the model to imitate the text. That can take some time. We all use GPUs or TPUs to speed up the training process, but in the end, it could take days or weeks to get a good model. But in the end, we get a network, a trained network. So what I'm going to show you here is a little diagram of how I draw GPT-2. So GPT-2 was trained exactly like this, exposing it to 40 gigabytes of web text by Alex Radford. It's a famous model. It was made by OpenAI a few years ago, and it's a big model. It has about 1.7 billion parameters, but conceptually, it's really simple. It's just a function. It's not going here. Let me see. I actually want to, if you give me a second, I'm going to see if I can get my little things to go here. I'm going to play with Zoom for a moment. I can't figure this out. Okay. Well, let's see. If I do this, okay, there it goes. I just have to sacrifice seeing all of you guys. So if you have any questions, don't just raise your hand, speak up, because I can no longer see you. Okay. So the idea is that, it's this big 1.7 billion parameter model, but in the end, it's actually really conceptually simple. It's just a function. You give it some input, a series of words, does a bunch of arithmetic, and then as output, it produces a prediction, a guess of what the next word will be. So here, the input is this part of a sentence that says, Edmund Neupert performing on the, now that's incomplete, and it will predict that the next word is, what GPT thinks comes next is the word piano. And actually, Edmund Neupert happens to be a famous 19th century pianist and composer, something I didn't know. But in this case, GPT-2 is right. Amazing, right? So when you prompt GPT like this, it seems to know a lot of things. So here's a few more examples, right? Edmund Neupert, Miles Davis plays the trumpet, Jimi Hendrix is on the guitar. It's great. You might not know who Niccolo Paganini is, but here again, GPT-2 is right. He's a famous 19th century violinist. So what's interesting here is that what we normally think of as facts, we normally think of facts as abstract relations about things in the real world, subject-object relations like you might put in a knowledge graph. But here, GPT-2 was just trained to predict words. It's just making language predictions. But somehow, in that process of predicting words, it seems to know something about facts in the real world. And so this idea of going to a language model and extracting facts from the language model by setting up prompts like this, it's an interesting idea. It's been studied by a bunch of labs. Petroni sort of kicked off this inquiry, and there's been a bunch of people who've looked at it. And you know, one of the things that people have noticed, Jiang did a good study of this, is that there are a lot of ways to say the same fact. Some of the ways of prompting these models to get facts out work a lot better than others. So you can try to optimize this. But it's interesting when you look at a lot of different probes of the same fact, sometimes you get this feeling that GPT doesn't really know what it's talking about. So let me give you an example. So for example, here's different ways of getting GPT to tell you, what does Edmund Neupert do? So there's just different ways of saying, like, what is he a master of? Well, depending on how you say it, GPT will predict he's on the piano, or on the violin, or just art. Or like, if you ask what like his favorite genre is, like, seems to think he's like an author maybe or something. So like when you see this kind of inconsistencies, you think, oh, well, maybe GPT-2 is just sort of guessing. But the interesting thing is that this inconsistency isn't always there. It's like, for example, if we do the same exercise with Niccolo Paganini, it's pretty consistent. He's always a violinist, regardless of how you ask. And even if you don't get the model to explicitly say violin, so then this last prompt here, the favorite genre of Niccolo Paganini, it's still consistent, right? The symphony idea is consistent with the idea that Paganini is a violinist. So studies of paraphrases like this were done by Elazar last year, and it's a very interesting study. And so we sort of come to this realization, there's a difference between knowing something and saying something, right? So your model can say something that's true, that happens to be true, like Edmund Neupert performs on the piano without actually knowing the fact, like this kind of thing. Or you can do the opposite. You can actually know something is true without explicitly saying it. Like, you can know that Niccolo Paganini was a violinist, even in the context of some other sentences that might not mention the violin at all. And so there's this gap between the exercise of predicting a good next word and like having some knowledge, but the model is sort of behaving like maybe it has some knowledge about some things, maybe not all the time when it's guessing words, but sometimes it seems to have this really interesting, robust knowledge, which sort of leads to this question, what is this? What is this knowledge inside the network, right? Is it something that we can physically find? Is there some physical reality to the knowledge that we could find somewhere in the network? And then the second is like, if we can find it, right, can we actually change it? And if we can change it, how do we measure it, right? Like, how do we know that that's actually knowledge that we've changed? So that's what this work is all about. It's basically a hunt for the elementary units of factual knowledge in a transformer. And we found some things, and that's what I'm going to share with you today. We'll start with locating the knowledge. And so, so how do we find where the knowledge might be in a network, right? So the network basically looks like this. The information flows in on the left and flows out on the right. So can we find knowledge in a specific place in all these computations, right? The information sort of flows from the right towards the right and towards the bottom like this. And maybe there's some computation in here that's more decisive than the other. So the idea is, let's copy some data around and use like interventions in this computational process to see if we can identify which threads of computation seem to be the important ones. Sort of like debugging a big piece of software. Like, we're going to go like change some lines of code to see if we can figure out what's going on. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. we're going to take this network and we're going to run it twice. So the first time we'll run it clean like this. Miles Davis plays the trumpet. It gets this nice clean prediction like this. But then we're going to run it a second time where we corrupt the input. So these little stars here basically mean let's add some noise to where the subject name would have been. So it's like a truck rolling by when you said Miles Davis plays the, you know, it, like the network can no longer hear the accurate person's name, is no longer able to correctly predict the instrument here. So this is like the second corrupted run. And so what we're interested in now is all those intermediate hidden states in the clean run. It was any of them, sort of decisive. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a clean hidden state from the clean run and copy it down into our corrupted run like this. And then once we copy that just one vector over, then we'll just allow the downstream computations to proceed as usual with this new transplanted piece of data. So usually when we do this, it doesn't really have any effect. Usually when we do this, it has no effect and the output is still corrupted. But once in a while, when we do this, as we test all the states, we find a state which if we copy it over from the clean run, it causes the prediction to change back to the correct information after it passes through all the rest of the computation of the network. And, you know, sort of makes, in this case, it would make the answer correct again, predicting trumpet. And it does this with just like copying over a single hidden state vector somewhere in the middle of the network. And so what that suggests is sort of, you know, suggests that that vector that we copied is on the decisive path or on a decisive path, which leads to this lookup. So let me show you a picture of what these paths look like. All right. So I'm gonna bring up the video for a second so I can see if anybody looks really confused. Okay, so this is a heat map here, which is really every state of a transformer as it's processing this sentence. I picked a slightly longer one here so you can kind of see what the heat maps typically look like. So this Brian De Palma works in the area of film. And where I show it in dark purple is the location of decisive hidden states here where if I transplant these individual vectors from the clean run to the corrupted run, it now recovers the ability to predict film. If I transplant a single hidden state in any of the white regions, then it doesn't have this effect. And so it's what's interesting when we do this is that the decisive effects are really localized in two discrete locations. So at A, I've labeled as A is like this early site. It's sort of always at sort of middle early layers, sort of from layer five to layer 20, layer 10 to 20 or so. And at one of the early tokens in the sentence. And then at B is this late site, which is always there. It's always at the last layers of the last token. If I transplant those, then it will recover the computation. Then let me show you a couple other examples. So here's another one. This is a sentence about a fact of where the company Zillow is headquartered. The headquarters of Zillow is in the downtown blank. It's in downtown Seattle. GPT seems to know this. And if we corrupt the company name, it doesn't know it. But if we restore a single hidden state at this early site here, like right here where it's darkest purple at layer 12 or so, then it does. Then it recovers this knowledge that it's in Seattle. And so, and the lighter purple ones work to varying degrees, and they lead to this sort of different predicted probabilities of the word Seattle, as you can see here. In the white regions, it's down below 0.2, and in the dark regions is up at 0.5, 0.6, or 0.7. So that's sort of the picture of what causal traces look like. You can actually do this trick in a second way, you can actually, so it's not just about corruption of the network. You can actually take two completely uncorrupted runs of the network on different sentences. So we can have a sentence about Shaquille O'Neal plays the sport of basketball, right? Or take another sentence about a different person, like Megan Rapinoe plays the sport of, and GPT will predict soccer. And we can take the hidden states from the sentence about Megan Rapinoe and also copy them over one at a time to the processing of Shaquille O'Neal's sentence. And when we do that, normally it doesn't do anything. Shaquille O'Neal continue to play basketball. This slide has a bug in it. So now if we copy it over in these little purple areas, we can make Shaquille O'Neal play soccer instead. And this shows what the probability of soccer is at these two different sites. So this is a thing that happens a lot in different types of sentences. What I've shown you is a few anecdotes here. We have some quantitative data I'll show you in a minute, but let me actually show you another setup here that is also interesting. So the states that we've been patching over are these like little purple states in this diagram, which are the hidden state in the model for any given token. And the way the transformer works is it actually goes through a couple pieces of processing at a layer before going to getting the next hidden state of the next layer. The first piece of processing is the attention map, where it sort of looks around at other tokens and gathers information, adds a little bit to the hidden state. And then the other is this MLP layer, which doesn't look around at all. It just does some internal processing. And then after doing some internal processing, manipulates the hidden state, adds a little vector to it as well. So the hidden state is actually the sum of the previous hidden state plus these two contributions. And so it's interesting to ask, is the decisive thing here, which is the sum of these three components, is the decisive thing from the red part, or is it from the green part? Is it from attention, or is it from MLP? And so what we can do is we can actually do this transplantation by copying over just clean green states, or copying over just clean red contributions, and see how it works. And so when we get this experiment working, so here's another sentence, just so you can see another example. Lawrence Taylor professionally plays the sport of, GPT knows this is football. And when we copy over the green states, then there are some locations when we copy it over where it will recover this prediction football from the corrupted state. And then if we do the red states only without copying over the rest of the components, then we can actually get football also recovered, but sort of in different locations. So what we see is the effect of copying over these green MLP states is stronger at the early site, and the effect of copying over the red attention states is sort of stronger at the late sites. And so what this sort of tells us is that attention, what it's doing is it's sort of has this important role here. It must be moving information down. Self-attention, basically it's a thing that allows later tokens to see what's going on with early tokens, and it has this information copying role that's been studied by a bunch of different people. There's been a lot of attention on attention. But this interesting thing about what these green states are doing is a little less well studied. There's been a couple labs that have been looking at this, and we're one of them. Okay, so let me. So I've shown you this with like a bunch of specific examples. If you aggregate this over a large number of factual statement sentences, then these trends all seem to be systematic. So this is averaged over 1,000 factual statements, and we see this clear segregation of an early site and late site location for decisive states, and at the early site MLP is very important, and at the late site attention is very important, but not vice versa. So this is sort of what the picture looks like. It suggests that that there's something interesting going on at the earliest site. Let me see. There's a point I want to make here, which I don't have on the slide, I think. But basically, this late site is really unsurprising. Right. The way the transformer works is it's a deterministic function that computes from top to bottom. And so the fact that you can go to the variables right before the final computation when you're going to output the probabilities and patch the correct data in here and have it give the correct answer is totally unsurprising, right? You're basically one computation away from the answer, and you stick this in and then it gives you the answer. You know, you can have GPT say anything you want by sticking something here pretty easily. So what's really surprising is this early site, right? What the heck is going on in this early site? We didn't expect to see this concentration of decisive states back here. It's sort of like, you know, I feel like the prevailing view of what's going on inside these neural networks is like it's an information gas, right? You know, you put in information in, and information bounces around everywhere in the network, and then finally at the end, you know, some magic answer pops out. But it doesn't seem to be like this uniform gas, right? There's this really concentrated site early on where there's also like this really decisive state, and in particular, it seems to be concentrated in the MLP layers here. And so the MLP layers are up to something. I'll show you another experiment that we've done that was really convincing to me. Slightly confusing, but let me describe this. So this in purple here is the same purple stripe as this early site purple stripe here in the first figure. So this is showing what the causal effect is of restoring a corrupted hidden state to the correct value here. And you see this nice peak here at around layer between sort of layer 5 and layer 15 or so. You know, if you restore these things, then it really does a pretty good job at recovering a lot of the predictive value of what GPT is able to get. Okay, so what I did is, you know, you run this experiment where we recover an individual state, but since these MLP layers seem to be sort of important, at the same time we knock them out. We freeze these MLP layers as if they were in the corrupted state. So we recover a hidden state here that's correct, but the hidden state could be picked up in the computation in a couple ways. It could be picked up by attention, where it would flow all the way through the rest of the network, or it could be picked up as an input to MLP, where it needs to be mediated by MLP before it flows through the rest of the network. And so I didn't, in this version of the pie, I didn't show you the attention version of it, but basically you see this big gap in just the MLP case. In the attention case, you don't see this big gap at all. Where if we knock out MLP at this layer, then basically these inputs really don't have the causal effect anymore. They need to flow through MLP, the MLP module of the network to have an effect. So we can think of the early layers, which have no effect without MLP, as sort of acting like an input that is needed to some essential computation. But then the high layers, which actually have some causal effect, even if MLP is knocked out, we can think of these states as like the outputs of some decisive computation, where now the computation is done. If we just copy over the output, then it has the desired effect. And in between, there's some essential computation being done by the MLP layers that is going away if we knock it out. And so you can see that in this gap between the purple lines and the orange lines. So I apologize. I have to come up with a better way of explaining this experiment, but for me, it's quite decisive. It shows that if the MLP layers aren't involved, then this interesting causal trace that we have goes away at these specific layers. And sort of it leads to this hypothesis, which is that factual knowledge might be stored in the mid-layer MLP modules, right? That maybe the reason that you know that Miles Davis plays trumpet is because that fact might be looked up in the computation that's happening in this green box here. So that's the hypothesis. So we've seen a bunch of evidence of this hypothesis, but it's all been a little bit circumstantial. So what's the way to really test this? And I see Nancy here, I'm looking at her. Remember from her class, like the nice way of doing a test of this is to do a causal test. Can you actually change something and have the effect that you want? And so we're going to take these MLP modules in the middle and ask the question, can we make a change in them that has the effect of changing knowledge? And I'll show you how we do that. Okay. So changing knowledge. Okay. So this is basically Eiffel Tower is located in the city of, another example, Paris, right? So we've seen from causal traces that the data sort of flows like this, and that there's some important thing going on at mid-layer MLP modules. And we're going to hypothesize that even though there's a lot of layers involved, that really any of them could have stored this fact, that they're all like sort of substitutable for each other. And so, so the idea is that we want to store a new fact. We want to put the Eiffel Tower in a new city. So like we want to store the fact that the Eiffel Tower is in Rome. And the way that we want to do this is, you know, when this MLP module is asked, you know, where is the Eiffel Tower? We want it to answer, do whatever its computation is. Instead of answering Paris, we want it to answer Rome instead. And so the way we think of this is that these MLP modules are sort of acting like a dictionary lookup. There's some dictionary data structure in there, which actually kind of, it matches this very classical way of looking at single layer neural networks. A single layer neural network can be viewed as just acting like a memory, right? So if you have a set of vector keys, which you can think of as addresses, and a set of vector values, these Vs, you can think of them as values, then you can actually just store key value associations by sticking them in a matrix, by solving this linear system of equations, you know, V equals WK. You can store a lot of facts in a matrix this way. Whenever you come up to this matrix and you multiply it by K, then the value that you stored will pop out. So a single layer of neurons implements a linear system like this. And so you can look at it as popping out values for memorized keys. Okay, so this is sort of a way to think about what single layer neural networks do. You know, in our big deep networks, we encode, interesting things as vectors like the Eiffel Tower or Paris, whatever. But this view of what a single layer neural network can encode goes way back to Cohona in 1972. They called it an optimal linear associative memory. And actually, they observed you could stick more than the number of dimensions of facts in these networks if you're willing to accept some error by optimizing, by solving at least an error minimization problem. So you can write down like this least squares problem and say, really what the job of the single layer of a network is to get as close as possible to the remembered value for any given key. So this is just linear least squares here. You hypothesize that the purpose of this layer is to minimize the error between values you're trying to remember and what WK pops out. Okay, so this is ordinary least squares. The nice thing about this is pretty easy to solve directly. This is a closed form solution for least squares. It uses something called the pseudo inverse, this is it written in normal form. Like this. And what I've done here is I've taken all the keys that you want to store and put them in a giant matrix K, where each of the, columns of K in my notation here have each one of the keys, and all the columns of V have the corresponding values. And so, so that's like the associative memory view. Cohonen like looked at this thing. He didn't really talk about how you can change memory if you want to update memory, but it's actually not hard to work out either. So what we want to do is we have a new value that we want to write into this memory and representing Rome instead of Paris, and we want to stick it in. Okay, so how do we do this? So what we can do is we can actually solve another least squares problem. So we want to have it act so that if you have a new version of our weight matrix W1 and you stick the query into it, Eiffel Tower, then we want it to say Rome now instead. We want this new constraint to apply. But now the same matrix, the same set of neurons, probably remembered lots of other things. And we don't want to change any of those. So we want to continue minimizing all the error that it was minimized before. That's what this first line is in purple. But then in yellow, we want to like put this matrix under a new constraint. It's got to pass through this point. Eiffel Tower goes to Rome. Okay, so this is actually another really, really well-studied problem in linear algebra. It's called constrained least squares. And you can also write down the solution for it and just solve it with algebra as well. This is a normal equation form of it. And the K and the V, you know, have the same thing with all the old keys and values here, except that there's this new term over here, this lambda K star business. And so this here is what's called, this is actually the outer product of two vectors, this lambda K here, this last thing. Interesting thing is if you, so let me take a moment here. So this thing is actually a rank one update. It's a very, very small update in the weights of the matrix. It's the outer product between two vectors, which is sort of, it's like this, it's rank one. It's sort of like the one dimensional analog of changing a matrix. It's like the smallest change in a matrix you can make. And so the interesting thing is if you take the new solution, this least square solution, and you put it up against what we assume that the matrix was before, this old solution for linear least squares, then most of the terms just all cancel out. And so it turns out that if you just use algebra to solve, like, how do you insert a new memory into one of these things, then the new matrix is equal to exactly the same as the old matrix, plus this little rank one update that we have. There's a little covariance correction that gets put in here when you do all the linear algebra, but it's still this like little rank one update. It's the outer product of a vector lambda with this row vector C inverse little k, right? And so lambda is actually sort of an encoding of the value that we want to put in, like Rome, and k is sort of an encoding of Eiffel Tower. And you just sort of, you can solve the algebra and put this in. Okay, so I'm gonna go through a couple other details here. But the general idea is like you stick this little change into the matrix and then you can insert a new memory. Now, that's for a single layer view. If you actually look inside a transformer, it's a little bit more complicated than that. There's actually, every one of these MLP modules has two layers in it. And so they work together to sort of as a sort of if-then logic. These two layers actually, it's really similar to this old two-layer network architecture called an extreme value machine. You can think of the first layer as like spreading out the representation of the subject word of Eiffel Tower to a much higher dimension. It goes from 1600 dimensions here to like 6400 dimensions, like 6400 neurons. And it spreads the representation out so that it's sort of easy to pick out a key for the Eiffel Tower. So Giva and Dai, another lab has been looking at this and they think that there's some sparse structure here with a really small number of neurons that select for Eiffel Tower. It's not what I'm looking at in this paper, but there's probably some interaction with sparsity here in this fan out. Now it's a second matrix here, which takes this like sparse, you know, high dimensional key for the Eiffel Tower and actually looks it up in a dictionary to say what it should mean. And here is where we're hypothesizing that it's looking up Paris. And so the idea is all we need to do to insert a fact is take this second matrix, this dictionary, decide on a key value pair that we want to associate, something that represents Eiffel Tower, something that represents Rome, and just jam it in using the algebra that we derived. Okay, so and then the way that we, so we're basically looking for a key that represents Eiffel Tower and looking for a value that represents Rome. And so the whole Rome method is basically we get a key by sampling the encoding of Eiffel Tower on a few dozen sentences, and we take the average, and that's like those are the set of neurons, that's the vector that represents the question for Eiffel Tower. And then we do an optimization, not over the weights of the network. We're not like fine tuning the network. We do an optimization over the signals, over the activations that flow through the network to say, what vector would we insert here that would cause it to say roam instead? And that gives us this value that we want to insert. And so we have this key that says Eiffel Tower. We have this value that encodes you should say roam. And then we just use it to stick it in as a piece of memory in this hypothesized memory data structure in this layer. Okay, so does it work when we do this? Just do this piece of algebra. Well, okay, yeah, here we are. That's the method. So does it work? Let's measure it. Okay, so one spoiler is, yes, it works 100% of the time, but in this weak way. It works in this weak way 100% of the time. So this method is basically 100% effective. Like if we insert a fact, like, the Eiffel Tower is located in the city of Rome. We use this sentence to figure out like how to make it, a vector that would say Rome. And, this sentence is part of our sample for what it looks like when it's seeing the Eiffel Tower. If we like arrange this single rank one memory update in this single layer to do this, pretty much 100% of the time, it will be able to parrot back this fact. If we prompt it with Eiffel Tower is located in the city of, and we ask it, what does it predict? It will predict Rome. Okay, so it can say Rome. A different spoiler is that there's actually a lot of different methods that you can use to change networks that will easily like make a network parrot back an arbitrary fact. And we can easily overfit a network to do this. And so we sort of wanted to know, something beyond this, beyond like this ability to parrot back this specific answer for this specific sentence, does it actually know somehow that the Eiffel Tower is in Rome? And so what are the hallmarks of knowledge as opposed to just saying? That's what we started the talk with here. And there are really two hallmarks, right? One is generalization, right? That when you probe the knowledge in different ways, if you like do rephrasings or change the context a little bit and probe the knowledge, then like the Eiffel Tower should still like be in Rome instead of Paris. Or, if it's fragile, then we've done something wrong. Like if you rephrase it, the question a little bit, and you, instead of saying the Eiffel Tower is located in the city of, and you were to like maybe phrase a question like, what city is the Eiffel Tower located in? And it went back to saying Paris, like we've done something wrong here. Like we haven't really changed the knowledge. So this is like the first thing that we want to test is generalization. Is it robust, this thing that we've done? And the second thing we want to test is specificity. So one of the things that we found is that sometimes if you do it wrong and you say like, oh, look, we'll take Shaquille O'Neal and, he plays soccer now. We can insert this fact so that Shaquille O'Neal plays the sport of soccer instead of basketball. Well, what'll end up happening is you can go to the model and you can ask, what is Bill Gates's profession? And it'll say, oh, well, Bill Gates is a world-class soccer player. He's amazing. And everybody plays soccer, right? There's this other effect that you can have, which is to sort of shift reality so much that like you've redefined what the words are, that maybe soccer, instead of it being some new fact about Shaquille O'Neal, becomes defined as this thing that everybody in the world does. So we want to see if we've identified a place in the network which changes knowledge with both generalization and specificity. And so there's not a lot of existing benchmarks to do this, so we actually had to create some new ones. But to get the idea, so like Eiffel Tower's in Rome, if this is like the original sentence, we could paraphrase it. We could ask about things, we can ask about generalization and different things. We can ask, how do we get to the Eiffel Tower? What do we eat near the Eiffel Tower? Or we can try to trick the network by saying things like, where's the Sears Tower, right? If all the towers have moved to Rome, then this would fool it, right? And so, so to do this, we constructed this data set. It's called Counterfact. We basically put together a couple other data sets that were out there and, bent it to our own purposes. So we have 21,000 counterfactuals. These are facts that are not true. Like the Eiffel Tower is located in the city of Rome. And then associated with each not true fact, we have a bunch of like related statements that we probe, like what are paraphrases, like where, you know, like where's the Eiffel Tower, or the Eiffel Tower is located in, you know, like different kinds of statements of the same thing. We have neighborhood prompts like where's the Louvre located in, you know, where's the Sears Tower. And we also like have these open generation tasks, like tell me about the Eiffel Tower, tell me about Paris, right? Just like generate some text for me, right? And then we watch the statistics on all these things to see what's going on. And so I'll show you a couple of things that we found. So this is, okay. So remember we had this, you know, early sight and late sight. We've got the MLP early layers and these attention late layers. And so we sort of have this question, like, does one of them control knowing, the other control saying? So we can kind of compare, you know, trying to insert a fact in one of these things versus trying to insert a fact in the other. And I'll show you what happens when we insert a fact using optimization to insert things in the attention layer. So we get things like this. So Eiffel Tower is located in the city of Rome. We can change the attention where lates so that it will, you know, 100% of the time, like, you know, parrot out that sentence. But when we test it against this sort of generalization thing, then we see things that don't quite line up. So if we ask, like, what is the Eiffel Tower? Then, well, the Eiffel Tower is one of the most iconic buildings in the world. That's great. But it'll start saying things like, it's a symbol of France, reminder of the French Revolution, it was in Paris, blah, blah. It still like thinks that like Eiffel Tower is very, very French. And so even though when we ask it to parrot out the exact wording that we asked it before, it will parrot it. If we ask it like a rewording, it like comes back to Paris. And it also shows some damage here. So here Eiffel Tower is right across the street from the Eiffel Tower. You know, it sort of lost its mind a little bit when we do this. So there's some other things that we also measure, which is it's different measures of fluency. Okay. So, but when we go and we do this in the MLP layer, so, and then we can, this is like, this is sort of quantified. And so we can show that, you know, over like thousands of these cases, that it's actually quite effective to change the weights at the attention layer. It's got pretty good specificity. It doesn't seem to interfere with other unrelated facts, but it doesn't generalize. It's not robust to simple rewardings of the same fact. Doesn't really work. So efficacy is high. Neighborhood is good. Zero is best here. And then here we're looking for paraphrase changes. We want it to sort of look, you know, we want the numbers to be pushed up just like they're pushed up in efficacy and the original statement of the fact, but they're not pushed up at all. They're sitting down here. They're not changed at all on average. So it doesn't do that. Okay, great. So MLP, you know, here's some examples. So Eiffel Tower is located in Rome, Italy. You know, so it compared it back. But also when we ask it to talk about the Eiffel Tower, it's like, oh, yeah, it's actually a symbol of Rome. And where is it? It's like across the street from St. Peter's Basilica. You know, it's got this idea that it's like this Roman thing now. That's quite interesting. And this is something that we can measure quantitatively. And so here it is again. The success is super high. So on the right is the attention edit. On the left is the MLP edit using our piece of algebra here, the rank one edit. And you can see it's basically 100% effective, even more so than the attention thing. It's still sitting at zero for interfering with neighborhood facts. It's very specific. But then the generalization is pretty good. When we have all these different rephrasings, then generally it'll answer yes, it's in Rome, you know, most of the time. And so let's see. So this is quite a difference between these two sites, and that's sort of why, as a shorthand, we're sort of saying, this site is about knowing something, and this site is just about saying something. It's about just arranging the words that you would say that would be like grammatically appropriate in this situation. But it's very specific to the situation. It's not really about abstract knowledge. Abstract knowledge seems to be here at this early site. Okay, so there's a bunch of other methods that people have used for training and fine-tuning these transformers to sort of customize them with, you know, specific information about your company or your application or whatever. People will take one of these big models and fine-tune them and teach them about toothpaste or whatever it is that you want your chatbot to talk about. And so So we compared to a bunch of these other methods, direct fine tuning. There's this interesting interpretable neuron method from another paper. There's this really cool idea of using hypernetworks. This is something that was really invented just a few years ago, and people are applying it to transformers. So we tried against all these different methods, but they're all these are opaque methods. This is an interpretable method. There's a mix of different approaches here, but our method is different in a specific way. We're pretty interpretable. We know exactly why it is that we're changing the layers that we do. We know exactly which layers we're changing. We're making a very small rank one change, and we're selecting it based on the encodings of the words that we're trying to insert into the model. And so the question is, being this interpretable, being like this explicit about what we're doing, can we outperform these giant black box methods that are trained on huge amounts of data, right? We take a single example, like a single sentence, how do we perform, right? Okay, so basically, yes, we outperform them. So there are two failure modes that you see in the black box methods. And one of them is...
Oh, awesome.
What did you say?
David?
Yeah, yes.
Just to let you know, we have an 8-minute warning.
8 minutes. Okay, I'm almost at the end. Okay, so there's two things to look out for when you're claiming that you've changed the knowledge of a network. I mentioned this before. One is you're looking for generalization and you're looking for specificity. And when you test generalization carefully, you'll notice that a bunch of the methods basically fail to generalize. So like if you use these fine-tuning methods, or if you use one of the hypernetworks called MEND, then some of our methods don't do that well at efficacy, but it's not a huge feat to get to like 99% or 100% on like, can you parrot back the example that you gave, right? So most of the methods can do this. They can parrot it back. But if you like reword the thing and ask, how do you do, then most of the methods cannot recover the fact in a reworded prompt. They are very, very fragile. And so the generalization is low. Now some of them generalize quite well. So there's a particular, we generalize pretty well in Rome. There's another hypernetwork that generalizes pretty well. But then there's this other thing to look for, which is specificity. Like, does Bill Gates now play soccer kind of thing, right? Is everything in Rome, all the Empire State Buildings in Rome, right? And so when we measure those kinds of things, we see that the rest of the methods fail in specificity. So like one easy way to generalize to make it so that on all the paraphrases of the Eiffel Tower, they're all the paraphrases in Rome, is you could move every site in the world to Rome. And that's a very easy way to generalize. And we found that the other methods are actually generalizing in that way. They're moving way too many things to have the attribute that the piece of knowledge that they're supposed to have. And so you can kind of see this here. But our method is extremely specific, right? It's it really doesn't affect the sort of facts that shouldn't be affected, the facts about other subjects that are nearby. So there's Rome in green with a bunch of green numbers, no red stuff. Works pretty well. It does pretty well at preserving fluency when you do this. And now it's not perfect. The numbers are not all 100% or whatever. There's some things, and I think that reflects, there's other things going on in the computation besides this simple dictionary lookup that we do. We don't understand all of them, but I think there's pretty good evidence that this dictionary lookup is pretty important. It's a pretty large part of what's going on. We can find it, we can change it, and we can like change it in this nice robust way that generalizes as specific. So there's all sorts of examples here of pieces of text that you can change. Let me show you some examples. So this is a Pierre Curie, who's a physicist. His much more famous wife, Marie Curie, but he also did physics and also worked with her on radiation research. But we could insert a counterfactual that he works in medicine instead and ask various methods to generate text about this. And you can kind of see The different types of failures that you typically see, it, you know, sometimes it'll work. The things, the cases where it works are in green, where it's sort of, you know, trying to transplant this famous person to be, you know, working in medicine instead. But here you have this example of non-specificity, like Pierre Curie was moved over, but Robert Millikan, who is another physicist, also got moved over to work on biology and the human mind and stuff like that. And Robert Millikan, I don't know if you remember, but he's like a physicist who worked with little oil drops and figuring out like the charge of the electron, things like that. So it has nothing to do with this stuff. So you know, this is an example of specificity failures. There's various examples here that we can look at of generalization errors. This example down here is like a fluency problem, where once you try to get the model to talk more about medicine, it likes to talk about medicine a lot. Once it mentions the word medicine, it just starts repeating the word medicine and so on. So like we've hacked like the wrong part of the system when we've used some of these other methods. And so this is just sort of an example of what you see. And so so let me wrap up here. So what we've shown is this like interesting way of threading through the computations in the network, something I call causal tracing. I should give credit to Pearl. This is really causal mediation analysis from the tradition of Perl, and what we've done is in a graphical form, and through a large language model, and call it causal tracing. And we've come up with a method for finding these sort of location of these facts and then changing them. We do these rank one model edits. So that's ROME, that's where Rome comes from. And then we have this way of measuring what we've done by looking at generalization and specificity. It's sort of requiring us to put together new data sets. And I feel like there's a need here. We put together a data set pretty quickly that, you know, shows some big change, you know, differences here between the different approaches. But I think that there's some need here for some better data that allows, you know, more detailed probing of these models. And so, you know, probing with counterfactuals is a pretty interesting area to look at, I think. Okay, so that's what we talked about. That brings us to the end of the talk. There we go. There's a little hyperlink to our website. Okay, there we go. I covered a lot. So, do you guys have any questions? Any questions? Happy to answer questions.
Yeah, okay. So I've got one. So it looks like the example that, or it looks like the method that you showed is pretty good at editing the entities in known relations, right?
That's correct.
So do you think that such a system, or maybe some like other method, could work maybe at changing the predicates in known relations instead? So for example, like the idea I had was, instead of saying like, athlete plays whatever sport they're associated with, right? You can change it to say athlete commentates on sport, or athlete watches the sport, and have it apply to all of the valid athlete sport like pairs, but like without changing the entire concept of playing or watching.
Yeah, that's right. I suspect that there is so the way that we have put together counterfact for testing is by pulling from like knowledge graphs. We pull all these facts from knowledge graphs, and we sort of use them to come up with these test cases like this. And so what we know about how well this method works is limited by what we've tested it on, basically by this sort of microscope that we've chosen to use. And I agree, it's limited. Like, we have not dramatically changed somebody's profession or the relationship they have with the sport or something like that. And it's likely, I think it's likely, that some of these broader things are also encoded the same way, but we don't know that because we haven't measured it. And like, this is sort of what I'm saying, that we sort of need to develop some better data to allow us to ask these questions systematically. I also think that there's probably a lot of things that models know that are probably not encoded this way. And it's pretty interesting to try to sort through them. Like, what is the model knowing through like a dictionary lookup kind of thing? And what is the model knowing through some maybe more complicated computation? We don't really know the difference between those two things. I think it's a very interesting research question. So thanks for the question, William.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
We have one question from Thomas, and then Nancy is next.
Cool. Thanks, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, thank you so much for the talk. It was super, super interesting. I guess one question I have is, it's not clear to me, I guess, what the desired behavior is in all of these edits. Like I saw with the case with, you know, changing Eiffel Tower associated with Paris to Rome, that it's really cool and desirable that it would start to say like St. Peter's Basilica is across the street. Yes. But like, let's say you had something like, you know, Joe Biden was born in the United States and you want to change that to like, was born in some yes. different country. That doesn't yes. necessarily imply that he should be the president of that country, right? Yes. Like maybe he was just born in that country yes. and then still became the president of this country.
Yes.
So like, it's not clear to me what is the desired behavior in all these cases and how do you go about sort of defining what it should or shouldn't?
Oh, this is so hard. It's a good question. I've been puzzling over this, with collaborators and with random people in the hallway. If you want to chat with me about it sometime, we can chat. What is a counterfactual? Like putting together this data set and realizing it's a data set of counterfactuals sort of made me like crack open the old philosophy textbooks about people have been arguing about counterfactuals for like hundreds of years. What the heck is a counterfactual? And what does it mean? And one of my friendly reviewers basically pointed at like our equation 10 when we do Rome. He says, aha, you can tell all the philosophers now. Equation 10, the rank one model edit, that's a counterfactual. Whatever the model says, that's when you change the model's, you know, understanding of a fact and it makes some other predictions, that's what a counterfactual is. Actually, it was kind of a joke. My friend Thomas Kohlhurst sort of made this joke that a counterfactual is whatever the model thinks it is, if you change it in the right place. But it's not that far-fetched to flip the question on its head and look at it that way. You know, I think that if you ask like Pearl what a counterfactual is, you say, oh, start with a graphical model of the world. And a counterfactual is sort of defined by, you know, what happens in your model when you do an intervention. And so what is a transformer, right? But it's like a giant graphical model of the, you know, the learned model of the linguistic view of the world. And so on one hand, we have this question of like, what does a human think would be true if you change a counterfactual? But then there's this parallel question of what does the model think it is? And kind of interesting to see what the differences are. So anyway, at least that's how I'm looking at the question. But yes, it's an old question. It's a little hard to untangle exactly what you would expect the implications of a counterfactual to be. Is that okay? So a non-answer to your question?
Yeah, definitely something to keep thinking about. And it's, yeah. I find it really, okay. really interesting philosophically. Yeah, thank you.
I think, yep. Nancy.
Yeah, this is so cool, David. Thank you. Maybe this is an incoherent question from it's kind of laughably neuroscientific, but you have just that concentrated green patch there. And I just keep wondering, what is so special about that early MLP site? How does it differ from other sites? Is there anything to be said about why all the facts land there?
Yeah, actually, okay. Do you ever see that? we all saw the Amy, what's her name? That science fiction story where she talks to the aliens. What's it called? Anybody remember what the name of that movie is?
Arrival.
Yes. And anyway, so Arrival. And the conceit in that movie was, it was really hard to understand what these aliens are saying because they don't have the same notion of the flow of time as humans do. Like they mix up the future and the past and so on. And so, you know, looking at like this concentration of state in transformers actually sort of, and maybe I've been looking at this paper too long, but it made me think of Arrival because the interesting thing about this particular location is this. This concentration at this green spot here is, it tends to be always at the last token for the subject name. So like Shaquille O'Neal, you know, is tokenized into a bunch of tokens by the model. But this green blob doesn't appear in Shaquille O'Neal's case until you get to the very last letter of the last name, right? O'Neal, right? And then all of a sudden, like this lookup happens. And if you think about it, that would be the efficient place to do the lookup, right? If you tried to look up Shaquille O'Neal a little earlier, actually in his case, you could maybe get away with just looking up Shaquille because his first name is so distinctive. But like Megan Rapinoe, there's a lot of Megans in the world, right? And you don't really know it's a soccer player until you get to the very, very end, right? And so it would be inefficient to like do a lookup any earlier than seeing like until you saw her whole name. But you could wait later. But if you waited later, it might be too late. You might need to know that she was a soccer player when you're predicting like the next word. It might be critical knowledge. So if there was a time for you to look up this fact that Megan Rapinoe was a soccer player, then you sort of have to be patient and wait until you have enough information, but then you have to immediately do it right away before it's too late when that information might be needed. And so I feel like there's this ugly thing in GPT about how it has this one directional, you know, it can only look at the past. I always looked at GPT and I thought, oh, it's such an uglier model than BERT and these sort of masked language models that kind of look both in the future and the past and everything like that. But I feel like the fact that GPT has this, you know, when it's doing this generation task, it looks in the past only, it forces it in that process to really concentrate its lookups of its factual knowledge. And so that made me think, oh, if we like analyze one of these arrival aliens, we might not see this, right? You know, this is this is something pretty interesting. And so anyway, it's just speculation, but that's sort of the, you know, my view of like when, you know, why this might happen in such a concentrated way. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Okay. Let's see. So the next on my list is Qian. Yeah. I can't see your first name because it's covered up by Zoom here.
Oh, sorry. Oh, hi.
Peng. Yes. Hi, Peng.
Yeah, nice. Thank you for the very interesting work. I have a quick question about when you look at this problem among different entities, do you found that certain entities are more susceptible to this change or because you have entities about person and also about locations, is there any differences across the behaviors models when you try to edit different kinds of entities?
I would say that the big difference that I've observed is not kinds of entities, but simply how well-known the entities are. So I could show you failure cases. So there's a lot of cases where this this causal trace is not as clean, and they tend to be cases where, like if, I don't have a causal trace here of Edmund Neupert. So if I showed you this example of Edmund Neupert, who correctly like predicted is playing the piano by the model, but if you look at the causal trace for Edmund Neupert, it hardly like has any concentration around his name at all, and is like, you know, really focused on hidden states in all the grammatical words around the sentence and everything, looking at everything, not really paying too much attention specifically to the fact that his last name is Neupert or anything like that. And so, I'd say that, you know, you have this concentration when it seems to be acting like it's a pretty famous person or pretty famous entity or something that the model actually knows about. Anyway, so that's at least that's the pattern that I've seen. Yep.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Josh.
Hey, hi. So thanks. This is very intriguing.
Cool.
I guess I haven't really studied it. I saw most of your talk and I looked at the demos and examples on the website. And I guess I'm interested in a behavior that your Eiffel Tower in Rome example shows on there, which makes me worry, I guess, about using words like knowledge here, because you know, you ask the system to tell you various things and it makes up some stuff, which it just makes up and like is runs counter to fact and like logical possibility, right? So like when you say things like, you know, where is, or tell me how to get from Berlin to the Eiffel Tower, it says something that like sounds plausible on the face of it, but then it tells you to go to a station, a train station, as far as I know, doesn't exist, like Roma Centrale. And it says it'll take you from Berlin to Rome. It'll take you 5 hours and 50 minutes when it's like an overnight train ride, right? So is that just randomness in the model, or is that a sign that like the web of stuff has been disrupted somewhat, or did it never even know that in the first place? Or like when you say, you know, what's the Eiffel Tower is right next to the Vatican. Okay. And then it says, and the Colosseum is just a few blocks away.
I know. And it's just like makes up this fact.
It totally impossible. Like the Colosseum is a few miles away. Is that stuff that GPT-3 or whatever just didn't know, or did it somehow get its whole geography of Rome got distorted from that? Like, and do you have ways of assessing that?
Yeah. I think that's right. I think this is, so there's definitely a difference between like knowing and guessing. And I think that,
There's like a web of associations, right? The way you described it as an associative memory makes a lot of sense. Like I would say, well, there's some associations and you are changing those in a somewhat targeted way. But I guess the question breaks into two things. One is, why not just call it associations rather than knowledge, which seems more like what it is.
Oh, I see.
Because like knowledge, knowledge is supposed to be true. This isn't true. But the other is, how well do you assess really whether you're really like able to change a single association without affecting that web? Because it seems like from at least those examples, which are quite interesting, because the freeform text generation gives you a lot of stuff in the local part of the associative web that actually you really are changing a lot of things that aren't even about Eiffel Tower, but just about like what you know about Rome and geography.
So let me defend our use of this very loaded word, knowledge. We were looking for a way of talking about, so I think that there's a lot of different associations in these models, and we can sort of edit them all. And there was a particular interesting kind of association that we were after, which is associations that really generalize and they're specific, that match up with the kinds of associations that humans have cataloged in knowledge graphs, these knowledge tuples. And so since like there's this history of like calling these associations between subjects and their attributes, you know, Eiffel Towers and Paris and things like that, as knowledge.
But like when Google builds a knowledge graph, they work really hard to verify that it's true.
No,
like, I remember.
I totally agree.
John Jandrea explaining that. That's a hard thing to do.
So you can't
call it a knowledge graph unless you verify that it's true.
I totally agree. And so, I guess I want to distinguish between, and maybe we should, really clarify this when we write about it, between the association between like Eiffel Tower and Paris, which really is a piece of knowledge. It's true. And the association is there and it's quite robust and it generalizes over lots of changes. And then there's all these follow-on things that the model doesn't know, like exactly where in France is Paris or exactly where in Paris is Eiffel Tower. Like the model, like GPT actually doesn't really have a lot of evidence of knowing these things in detail. It has a bunch of other loose associations and things it may be guessing, but there is an association between Eiffel Tower and Paris that that the model seems to be quite robust about. And we are able to change that association in a way that seems to continue to be robust. We can associate Eiffel Tower now with a different city in a way that also is robust. Now, all the follow-on things that it guesses, I'm not counting those as knowledge. Those are just sort of linguistic pieces of evidence that it seems to have gotten the topic
maybe,
right.
It sounds like what you want is that the relational specific. I think maybe you want a word that's like relation. Like, can you affect a single relation?
Yes.
Which is like you're trying to express a precise relation with like a predicate, a subject and an object, or a two-place tuple or something.
That's
and
exactly what we're looking at.
Right.
Yes.
But like, that's not what the word knowledge means. And also,
that's right. So right. Maybe a little closer is like, so. I try to couch it as, we're really focused on factual knowledge as opposed to, there's a lot of other types of knowledge and there's these, maybe we should call it like associational factual knowledge or something like that, to be really precise. But I agree. We're looking at this very, we're looking at this very thin, but I think interesting, subcase of knowledge, and we're trying to pin it down.
I think when you're working in language, there's some,
yes,
you know, like it's I don't know how to make an analogy to some of the vision things where you've looked in, but it's like, you know, there's like very important things, I think, in like language and meaning, and that connects to things that philosophers have written quite a lot about with lots of formalism. And I think it's important to make contact with that in a deep way.
And, that makes sense.
And, you know, like distinguish, like you're looking to, I think the math that you have is not math of knowledge, it's math of associations. And you did a really nice job of explaining the tradition and the connection to classic, you know, linear associators and all that sort of things. So, but you want it to be more precise than just any kind of vague association. So there's a particular kind of like associative relation or something. And I think it'd be good if you had a vocabulary that was about that.
That
so
makes
that
sense.
Maybe people like me didn't get distracted about like, well, does GPT-3 actually really know any of these things? And did you affect them or not?
Right.
Because like a knowledge graph, that's partly why like people who like symbolic approaches, like a knowledge graph actually, like there's many ways in which a traditional knowledge graph and the ways you might modify it would be, I think, much, much more powerful and robust than what you're currently showing.
That's right. Yes.
Anyway, we can talk about that more offline. But
no,
it's,
I'd love to.
It's very intriguing stuff, and I'm glad you're going this direction. I just want
Thanks, Josh. The thing I like is, I feel like, you know, even if you have qualms about, you know, the way that we're looking at it, I think that I'm quite happy that I've gotten your attention.
Okay. I'll let you finish it.
Thank you very much for I think this is very well taken. Feedback. Thank you, Josh. I see Anna has a hand up.
Hi. Thank you so much for your talk. I think this is very cool. And yeah, I love this attempted dissecting information flow and transformers and like the, you know, latent knowledge associations, whatever you want to call them, whatever Josh wants to call them. I have two questions, and one is more technical. So if there's like a quick answer, that'd be great. But if not, like I can just look at the paper. And one is more conceptual. The technical one is that in order to alter your associations, you need to have the key and the value pairs, right? And so the key for the Eiffel Tower, I can kind of guess how you're getting. You can just like feed the Eiffel Tower to the network. But how are you getting the value vector like located in Rome?
Yes. So I would say that let me find the slide here. So the value we're actually just getting through an optimization over an intervention. So let's see. I guess this is as good a slide as we have. Yeah. So here we have. So basically, if we run the network, on this target sentence, the Eiffel Tower is located in the city of. Then what we can do is we can actually do this transplantation technique. We can put any vector we want as the output of this MLP and then see what happens. And if we put like a random noise vector here, then it'll, instead of saying Paris, it'll just say some garbage here, right? But if we put a different vector here, but then if we look at gradients, we can say, oh, if we perturb this vector to get closer to Rome. And so we basically do gradient descent until we find what vector you would put in this specific location that would get this pretty close to saying Rome. And so we do this, you know, we do this optimization, we regularize it to try to make sure that we're not changing the vector too much. And then we say, okay, that's the target vector. Whatever we can stick in here that when we run it through the network will cause it to say Rome. Now,
so it's specific to the key, right?
That is so this vector that we put in here, we do an intervention so this vector is the thing that would have been output by the MLP here, but we, in this case, for this token at this layer, we don't actually use the output of the MLP. We sort of do this do operator. We sort of stick in a new vector and then just use that instead of whatever the MLP would have normally done. Now at all other tokens and at all other layers, you know, the computation proceeds as normal. But at this one, it's sort of like hot wiring the network. We're just directly feeding in some vector here. And we're asking the optimizer to figure out what vector would you directly feed in here to make it save Rome. So this is very different from like the normal, you know, sort of optimization you do when training a network or something, because we're not changing the weights of the network at all. Instead, we've sort of snipped the network here, and what we're optimizing is what information, what vector do we feed in to this exact spot in the computation that would have the effect that we're looking for. And so, does that make sense?
Would the same vector work if the key was different, if you were changing the White House location to Rome, or is it specific to the key?
Yeah. So if you put it exactly in the same place, it would. We haven't found that it works. It like is different, but we don't know if it's. It's reusable for these vectors, but we haven't been able to do that yet. And so that's sort of, you know, that is, I'd say that this is sort of an unfinished part of the work, mapping out what the space of these value vectors is. So this embedding space for what the value vectors is kind of opaque to us right now.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Cool. Yeah. And then the second question was, key value mappings idea is very cool. What do you think about cases, which I would say are the majority of cases, and like where there isn't a single key value pairing, right? If you were to say like anyone of us studied at, right? You could say MIT, but you could also say University of Miami where I went for undergrad, or my high school or something else, right? A musician can play violin and the piano. What do you think about those like non-one-to-one mappings? And like probably there's some kind of probability distribution associated with which one you want to go with in which case.
Yes. Like things where you have multiple things that are true. That's right. Is Joe Biden president or a senator? Maybe he's been both. That kind of thing. I think that I don't have great answers for you here. It's something that we're actually in the midst of studying, sort of get a little bit better view of what the capacity of these things are. I can kind of share anecdotes or like intuitions. I think that there's some limits, and I think that some of those limits might actually be interesting, right? They might actually reflect sort of limitations of what, you know, GPT is able to do. I think that if Michael Jordan both plays baseball and basketball, which is true, he's done both. I think it might be very hard to store in the model both of those facts at the same time. And it's just like, you know, we couldn't figure out how to encode it, but it may be that GPT is incapable of entertaining both of these things at the same time as well. And so, anyway, I think this it's a reasonable question. We don't really know the answer to it. It's things that you can try to do by trying to, you know, insert more than one thing at once or trying to find a vector that represents both at once, but we haven't, you know, we don't have a clear view of it. We haven't had, you know, direct success at doing, you know, complicated interventions like that.
Gotcha, thank you.
Yep.
It's okay, really so good question, I think we'll wrap up here.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, David, for your time and for everybody for coming.
Thank you, everybody.
See you next week for Conflang next week.
Excellent. Thanks a lot. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thank you, David.
Cool.